Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got old friend and former bandmate, Sean Drysdale. And we also have a musical performance from Sean. He was kind enough to record something on his acoustic guitar and send it in. And it's very fitting because I love ending these shows with music. There's something really wonderful about it. And today is special, and it requires something special. The thing that's special about today is that this, episode number 75, not counting the specials, mind you, but episode number 75 of Coffee Over Suicide is the end of season 2. That's right. The season has ended, and now we move forward into 2020, and a new season will be coming soon. Now, there's a lot of things up in the air about when the season's going to premiere, who's going to be on it, where it's going to come from. Is it going to come from Denver, Colorado? Is it going to come from sunny California? We don't know. You'll have to stay tuned on that one, and I will definitely keep you posted. There's a lot of things in the works. There's a lot of moving pieces. And when you start collaborating with other human beings, there's some give and take. Like the wife and I have a give and take, and that's why we've been able to maintain this long-distance relationship for the past year. Because I thought we could handle it. We're both sort of emotionally mature enough to handle it. That doesn't mean it's always graceful or that it's always awesome, because quite frankly, if there's one thing I've learned about this whole experiment, is that long-distance relationships are a special kind of hell. It's not great. I wouldn't recommend it. And it definitely takes a certain level of self-awareness and strength to manage. And some days I don't handle it well. I just don't. But that's all right, because there's always another day and another chance to do better than I did before. And Sean and I get into a lot of that as well. We get into kind of picking yourself up and dusting yourself off and taking some of that Midwestern grit that you used to take for granted, and recognizing that there's a strength to it. And it's not always positive. Sometimes it can turn around and bite you in ways that you don't expect, but we get into all of that. And did I say there's going to be a song at the end of this show? I think I said there's going to be a song, so definitely stick around until the end, or at least, you know, hit the fast forward button when you get bored, until the end. I want to thank everybody who's stuck with this show for the entire year. My pals over at Comedy Film Nerds, by the way, the Kickstarter is still going until December 10th. You have until December 10th to back Rise of the Kung Fu Dragon Master. It's an amazing project. You should go check it out. Go to Kickstarter right now, Rise of the Kung Fu Dragon Master, and check that out. Also, I'd like to thank podcastguests.com, the first people to really push and help this show really grow and expand beyond what I was capable of on my own. They were a lot of help, putting me in touch with some really great people who were interested in sharing everything that made them tick. And the fact that people have been willing to come on and talk about failure and regrets and pain and mental health issues, it's really been really amazing. And I can't thank everyone enough for their bravery, their friendship, and honestly, their fun. This has been a blast, and I cannot wait for season 3. I have some more surprises in store when season 3 kicks off, but we can't talk about that until 2020. So you know what we'll do instead? We'll raise a glass. We'll toast ourselves for doing the best we can with what we have. And we'll listen to this conversation with Sean Drysdale.
Wake up for my day off.
Good. Yeah, it's my day off too, so this is fortuitous.
Yeah, well, I became a carpenter by accident. I've been out of work, so it's been interesting.
Yeah? Well, tell me about that. Let's take me into that. So how – actually, you know what? Let's go back a little farther than that. Let's go all the way back.
All right.
Yeah, where were you born?
Saginaw.
Right there in Saginaw.
Yeah, right there in good old stinky Saginaw.
I knew you were a native.
I am a native. I don't know how I pulled it off, but I guess my parents liked each other enough to squirt me out there. So
I guess. I know a little bit of your story. You know, the strange thing is we've known each other for a number of years.
I would say a little while.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is that while I feel like we know each other pretty well professionally, there are still like personal things that just slip through the cracks somehow.
Oh, you mean like everything about me? I'm good at that, man.
Yeah.
I've always been kind of a ghost in the wind, haven't I?
Yes. And that's why I want to know, I want to know how somebody becomes what you are.
Oh man, that's problematic almost.
It could be, but I want you to take me through that. This is already off the rails. We haven't even really started yet.
I grew up, are you familiar with the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes?
The wrestler.
Yes, the wrestler.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like the Michigan version of him, except instead of being the son of a plumber, I'm the son of a sugar beet farmer.
No way.
Yeah, my dad was in Pioneer Michigan Sugar his whole career, playing with sugar beets. So when I say stinky, I grew up in a very stinky house.
Yeah,
if you're not familiar, sugar beets are pungent, but now to me they smell sweet.
Huh? You know, it's one of those palate things.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like people who say they hate Gouda. I'm like, then you just haven't had enough Gouda.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I'm just saying, it's pungy on the front, but man, I tell you what, when you get used to it, you can basically choke anything down at that point.
Well, and sugar beets, was that something that you ate around the house a lot? Did he smuggle them home or anything?
No, he just brought the smell with him. I mean, they're right. Quite a pungent beet.
So it was fuck these things.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, like, it was pretty brutal, and then I don't know, after years of exposure to it, I guess like anything, you just Stockholm it and you go, oh, it's not so bad.
Now you think of dad when you smell that.
Yeah, you know, well, that or booze. I mean, he was quite the drinker, so. Put both of them together, and I swear he's in the room.
You have a brother, right?
Yeah, I got a older brother and a older sister. I still talk to my brother. My sister is pretty estranged. She suffers from mental illness. And it made it hard as a kid growing up dealing with it, because she went off the rails about 11 years old and started like running the streets and being just nutty.
Yeah.
Just nutty, you know, and we didn't know how to figure it out then, because there was nothing for mental health, you know, in the early 90s, how to deal with people. It was just like dope them up with something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, take these pills and shut up.
Yeah, and you know, my family was really poor, so when they ran out of money for pills, it just kind of went back to crazy sister time, and eventually she ran away for good and never came back unless she needed money, which was the worst place to go because we were poor.
Right. Yeah, but it's also the only people who are likely to give you their last dollar.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of, I guess, you know, the meekness of it all, whatever you have, you will give type thing, so that's kind of the the way she always kind of ran back home. But I mean, dude, like, I always joke with people. We were so poor growing up. We used to eat spaghetti like 4 times a week. And, yeah. You know, you'd get home from school and you'd be like, "Hey, Ma, what's for dinner?" And she'd say GDS, and what it stood for was goddamn spaghetti.
Nice.
So a lot of GDS, I guess, was what we were growing up on.
Oh yeah, spaghetti, potatoes.
A lot of potatoes, but yeah, being Scottish, of course you gotta have potatoes.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a staple for just about anybody in the Midwest, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, at this point in the world, it's probably the only crop that everyone can just say, "Okay, I'm cool with it."
Right.
If you ever meet a person that's like, "No, you know, I'm not a big fan of potatoes," you better 86 them out of your life quick.
Yeah, that's a person who's never had to fight for food.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, "Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of a open-faced sandwich." It's like, what? Didn't even know those existed.
So what about you? As far as everything in a household like that, I mean, was that pretty volatile as far as...
It was nutty. It kind of led me to being a hermit. I didn't really want to have to ever get myself into another kind of home life like that ever again. So when I got old enough to leave, I left and never went back. I mean, never needed to run home. There was one time where I did go back for a hot second, but it was so short and not so sweet because it just was basically sleeping on a couch for a little bit. But no, it kind of trained me early on for life. And you realize that things ain't going to be easy and nothing is a handout and all those other kind of tired phrases and things of that nature. But, you know, it trains you when you get kind of a home life like that. It really teaches you got to kind of figure it out on your own.
It does. But the other thing that it can do is it can give you a lot of the negative aspects of constantly being in a mode of self-defense.
Yes.
That can have its fingers in you in all of the other areas in your life where you don't necessarily need it, and it can cause you some problems.
Oh, I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, when you're dating or married or whatever you choose to be, and there's the family functions and everybody invites you and you go and you do your best to ham it up and all that, but then they're like, "Well, where's your family?" And I'm like, "Not coming." Like, they never expressed interest when we were kids. Other kids weren't allowed in our house. My mom's like, "We are not feeding your friends are not coming over, they're not staying over, there's no money for them." And because of that, there's no need for them to be in my house.
Yeah. Yeah.
So trying to explain that to people, especially people who are like, "Oh yeah, I have this great relationship with my family and we do all these outings." And I'm like, "That's cute." Like, that's my first thought. It's a terrible thought to have, but.
So you just decided it was better to keep things at arm's length rather than invite them in to cause more chaos.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, especially like when you're in a situation, like I said, like if you're with someone or something along those lines and they want to do the whole families have dinners together, I'm like, "Ain't going to happen for me. So get used to it, or this ain't going to work."
Do you think that you gathered, any of the mental health issues from your family?
Oh, I'm sure I'm screwed up and don't know it, but
I'm sure you do know it.
Well, I mean, I think nowadays everything is so much easier to figure out that there's like these support systems and there's these abilities to self-reflect in a way I think that didn't exist even, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think we're all still learning about ourselves. I'm not going to jump any guns and say I have any one particular diagnosed issue, but I mean, yeah, I mean, family messes you up, man. Growing up messes you up, and you just hope that you make it as an adult and you just don't shits the bed too bad, you know,
Well, and one of the ways that you decided to put yourself together was music, right?
Yeah. I mean, no one in my family was into anything. I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a cartoonist and an illustrator.
No shit. And then
I realized I couldn't draw when I got into college and I took 2D, cause you know, you have to take 2D hand, freehand art. Then I was taking graphic design and going into broadcasting. And I was like, man, if I could get good at doing drawing, you know, hand, like hand drawing and stuff. Maybe I could do special effects for movies because, you know, being a kid my age at that time, what were you going to see in the theater other than a big CGI fest? It was like,
yeah,
Godzilla came out. And even though it was the worst movie ever, everybody was like, I don't know, but did you see how cool that Godzilla looked made by a computer? Like,
yeah.
Like now looking back, you're like, wow, Jurassic Park 93 was way better on every level of like graphic, you know, CGI and stuff. And yeah, even today it looks better than a lot of films. It should just blow people's mind that that was being made in 1990 to be released in 93. Like, it's insane.
It's absolutely insane.
The technology has not changed that much. It's it's kind of sad.
Well, it takes a lot of work and a lot of money. And just like any other area of advancement, it reaches a certain peak where just about anybody can do it, and people start to get lazy.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've started to figure out, you know, through high school, if the art, the kind of cartooning and illustration didn't work, I got into band in middle school and stuck with that. And of course my parents hated it because the first thing they said was, we're not buying you anything. So I had to get a summer job and bought my own instrument, you know.
How old were you when you did that?
I was, 13.
Nice.
I think I was 13. I did a little bit of like working under the table.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, just, you kind of learn to hustle when you're from Saginaw a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, I always thought that I was a lazy person, but then I look back and I talk about some of my experiences, and I was constantly shoveling driveways, mowing lawns, washing dishes. One summer I actually even did some farm work with like a bunch of migrant farm workers.
I remember you telling me about that. You had some dude, because you're good with impersonations. You used to riff on this one guy you worked with out there, and basically you never understood what he was saying, so you would just start speaking basically gibberish.
Yes, completely.
It's kind of like what's his name on Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah, it was a way of survival too, because you know, once you can come into any situation and try to diffuse it with a joke, people usually leave you alone. Either that, or they get even more angry and they kick your ass. But
yeah,
it's worth the risk.
Yeah. Try being the guy in a work trailer, you know, in a carpentry field, and not being the Trump supporter. Even though...
Oh, you're not wearing the hat?
Well, even though you're in a union, you would think like, oh, you joined a union, you'd probably be a little more, a Democrat or a liberal or not Republican, because they're the ones that try and, you know, bust up unions and right to work laws and all that. Yeah. And you try and crack a joke, and then like it's like the room goes dead and you're sitting there eating your food and silence, and people just hot mad at you. So in my case, I don't have that kind of social skill.
Well, I mean, there's a time and place.
Yeah. And never there. So I learned that quick. I learned so much lying doing carpentry. Like the last job I did was building a bridge, and this guy was like, are you into Christian rock? And I was like, hell yeah, I am. And what's funny is in high school I grew up with a kid, funny enough, named Jeremiah, who was really big into a band called Newsboys.
Yeah,
and they were like the rock and roll Christian band where the drummer was like Tommy Lee and he's on the thing that's spinning upside down and all that. And so at that point, that guy was in really good with me. He's like, this guy likes Christian rock, man. Amen, Jesus. And I'm like, hell yeah, brother.
Yeah, but you're Jewish.
I turned everything into like pro wrestling speak, because that's my other passion, was pro wrestling.
Yeah, and actually, so, like, it seems like in the Venn diagram, you would have found a sweet spot with somebody.
Yeah. And so like what I end up doing is I just, how would a wrestler do like a promo with his buddy? And it's always like, hell yeah, brother, brother. Always say brother twice. It means something to them. You know, in the construction field, when you drop a brother, brother, it's like, amen, brother, brother. Everybody's around you, brother, brother. And man, it's hilarious. It's the weirdest ripple effect you'll ever witness.
But how did you, talking about your first hustling jobs, putting money together to buy instruments, what was your first instrument?
bass on purpose.
Yeah.
That's what I always tell people. Bass on purpose. I wanted to learn bass. I had this really cool ass neighbor who was a police officer named Mr. Meeks. His first name was Walter, but he didn't call adults their first name.
No.
So he's always Mr. Meeks, Officer Meeks. And he played keyboard, and his son, Walter Jr., of course, but we called him Tutor because he farted all the time. He played drums, and I'd hang out at their house because they were like the only other family on the block that like was cool, like my family, as far as being a neighbor, but yeah. Also they were black. So of course, like the old neighbors didn't like them.
Right.
Like the old white neighbors were all pissed off at this black family. But what's funny is he's a cop, and aren't white people supposed to like blindly love police officers?
Well, the white ones.
Oh, the white ones. That's how that works.
Yeah, that's how that works.
I missed the last memo at the meeting. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you've been in Saginaw your whole life. I mean, you should understand that strange level of segregation that city has.
It does. And so, like, we hit it off. And I was Walter Jr.'s buddy, and his dad had all these kick-ass records, and he played keyboard. And he had, like, it was the first time I ever heard Billy Preston in my life,
yeah.
Who turned out to be one of my all-time favorite artists. If you know me, you know I love Billy Preston.
Everybody loves Billy Preston.
Well, you'd be insane not to. But then, like, he had, like newer school stuff at the time. Like, he had, like, Q-Tip, and he had some, like, you know, some of the cleaner hip-hop, because he was trying to still keep Walter from getting into some of the sweary stuff. And
right.
So there was some Tribe Called Quest, and there was, like, some early J. Dilla stuff. And so, like, it was cool, man. Like, they got me hip to music, and bass was really heavy in it. So I just thought, bass is cool, man. Like, all the kids play guitar. No one plays bass. I'm going to be the cool kid. Turns out that's not the truth. But I was like, I'm going to learn bass. And so because I did that, everybody, when you get to like 16, 17 years old, kids are trying to start bands. They're always like, hey, you play bass. And I was like, hell yeah, brother.
Yeah, I had that same thing going on with drums. It was just I thought, yeah, this is what cool people do. The rhythm section is the coolest part, and then you realize it's not. It's just you play a show, you sweat more than anybody else, you smell like cheese, and it's
just the Gouda.
Yeah, exactly. But if you can get past that or through it, you learn to appreciate those things.
Yeah, exactly. And so you just kind of figure it out as you go along. That's why, like, when I did a little bit of teaching music to kids, when I worked at a retail music center, which wasn't a guitar center, it was just like a locally owned thing.
Yeah.
They'd always ask for, like, what's the best insight? Or they'd want to, run before they could crawl. And I just told them, I'm like, have a really good attitude of dealing with people who are going to upset you.
Oh, man. Yeah, so how did you lie to them about that? Because you didn't do that.
No, of course I didn't do that. I had an attitude when I wanted to have an attitude, and I was quiet when I didn't want to deal with it. I just told them, like, you're going to learn real quick that you'll deal with people who might not be as motivated as you, or will be more motivated than you. Because it works both ways. Sometimes you end up with a cat that's way more talented than you are, and you're like, why am I even here?
Yeah, completely.
I'm like, this is not my comfort zone. This is out of my wheelhouse, my bubble. And I just told him, I'm like, you're going to feel like a failure all the time, but the only person you ever have to answer to is yourself. So get used to it.
That's actually pretty profound advice anything.
Because you're the one who has to go home with you. You're the one who has to take that drive back to wherever you live after a rehearsal or a show. And you run all that stuff through your head. Like, you're in your own echo chamber, unfortunately, and there's no way to shut it off. If you're a musician, there seems to be, with all musicians, some type of crazy hypervigilance. The way the mind works, the way it kind of, like, cascades over itself constantly when you've been really creative or you're rehearsing or doing a show. It seems like that when you come down, it's like getting off of cocaine, man. Like, your brain is so filled with its own serotonins and stuff that, like, you come down hard sometimes.
But that's that analytical self-defense again.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just a way of being able to look at a situation and say, I need to be prepared for this to go sideways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you need to be able to step sideways too, even if it's just the local band and you're dealing with your friends, because you don't want to ruin a friendship with a buddy you've had for years because you guys sucked at playing music together.
Yeah. Lord knows that's never happened.
Yeah. Right. But like, you got to figure that stuff out. It may not be as soon as you like, but it's beneficial down the road to start playing the game. You know, never give a compliment expecting to get one back was another thing I used to tell people. I'm like, don't walk around hoping to get compliments because you are not going to get them.
Well, I mean, you probably learned that from your dad.
Yeah.
So what was your first band experience?
I think my first one was I joined a band called Sworn, and it was a metal band, and I was listening to funk music and The Cure. Because also, if you know me, The Cure is also like another one of my diehard favorite things of all time everness.
Well, of course. I mean, it speaks to that core of sadness.
Yeah, kind of. And what's funny is like my favorite songs are the dopey happy ones, like Mint Car off of Violent Mood Swings, mm-hmm. which is a hilarious name for a Cure album.
Yeah.
Because everyone hates it, but like that song has so many goofy, whimsical things, and like they were never a goth band. I mean, he had the look because he stole it from Susie and the Banshees. He didn't look like that before Susie. He just kept it afterwards.
Yeah. But what about you? So you joined this metal band, and I imagine that worked out great.
Oh, it was awful. It was. What's funny is I had no problem playing with the drummer. The guitar player knew a lot of like early onset music theory, but he didn't know how to apply it. So it was a lot of him noodling, trying to find the key. And I'd just be like, it's in C. It's in C. I'm like, noodle in C. And he couldn't figure stuff out. And he was actually a really cool dude. And I just ran into him not too long ago. And, you know, we joked about it for a second, but yeah, it didn't turn out. The drummer, which is funny, was Saginaw is known for some interesting characters as far as like things you wouldn't expect. He was like the only other black dude playing metal.
Yeah. Yeah. There were very few.
There was Shay from Midori. I'm sure you remember Midori. I don't know what he was. I don't remember his band before that weird psychedelic metal funk. I don't know what it was before Midori. I just know he took over Midori. And then we had Alicia.
Right.
And that was it for, you know, having black people in like the rock scene for us for a long time. Like,
yeah.
So he was really good. And his dad hated it. So we got along really well. His dad was a Navy man. And his son's so listening.
Harsh parents.
So we connected there. He used to listen to Mushroomhead every day. That was his thing. That and what was the other one? Any band that had Head in it. Head PE or whatever that band was called. What was there? Mushroomhead. Wasn't there one called Godhead? Had a dude that looked, that was like a bald-headed Peter Gabriel before Peter Gabriel went bald or something. I don't remember. It wasn't my flavor of music, but we hung out and he ended up moving all the way across the country and, you know, following in his dad's footsteps. And so I just kind of muddled around, just did little things here and there and started showing up at other musicians' shows with my bass with me, acting like I'm going to go play with them.
Well, just and like with like a that. Lot of musical experiences, especially when you start joining rock bands and things, was the booze an issue for you pretty early?
It wasn't pretty early. I would say towards the end, when Banana was done, our old band, in case people don't know.
Yeah.
We were in a band together called Banana Convention. And it only really, there was like a two and a half year stretch where it was little rocky with the sauce.
Because you kept it pretty under wraps most of the time.
Yeah.
Like as far as I remember, because you knew that your dad had something and you and I kind of had that same thing. It was like, you know, whereas you were like, I know how to handle this. At the time, I was just afraid of it. So I was like, I can't mess with this at all.
Yeah. And it was basically when we were all done, you know, just completely done, not doing like these one-offs. And I was kind of left to my own devices and I was going through some really bad relationship stuff. And I was just like, well, hey, this makes me sleep really well because I wasn't ever one to get sauced up and start fights, or I was usually jolly.
Right.
I was pretty jolly guy when I drank, and funny enough, it was whiskey.
Yeah.
You know, the complete opposite effect for everyone else. I'm like, hey, let's have some whiskey and go to bed.
Right.
So that was an issue. And I kind of went through that strife and knocked it off. And then now, just nowadays, I just don't really at all, if ever, anymore.
Yeah, I kind of went through the same thing. And I didn't really even realize that I had become someone who's pretty habitual with it. And I was using it for a sleep aid. Completely.
Yeah.
Like if I didn't have a couple of glasses of wine or a bottle of wine, I was not going to sleep. And that was it. And once I quit drinking, you know, for, let's say, you know, for my Tylenol PM, it was a really strange transition going back to that. How do you get yourself to go to bed? Like what was it that I was avoiding for all of these years?
Yeah, that's a training lesson, man. That is, there's only one way to learn that lesson, and it's to figure out what it's like to not sleep because of it. Like,
yeah.
Relearning sleeping habits is one of the weirdest, hardest things, like outside of like quitting smoking. I think that was one of the hardest lessons.
Yeah. Because you don't get a day off. I mean, if you're a certain kind of person, you're just going to go to work anyway, whether you're exhausted. Being tired isn't an excuse to not do the things that need doing.
Yeah, you can't say, oh, I'm going to pay this bill late because I wanted to sleep in. It doesn't work.
Yeah,
sorry, completely. Can't pay my rent today because I felt like taking a nap for the first time in 2 years, you know?
But with all of that, too, did you find that there were, I don't even know how to put it. Like, I know that for me, the thing that happens is if I have too much silence, something will rush in to fill that silence. And it's usually, my own voice telling me all the things that I'm not getting right.
I mean, yeah, that's there. I don't know if it's the same for me. I think we're all wired, you know, so differently. For me, in silence, I'm actually pretty good. When things are like half, like you have a day that's sort of busy, but not busy at the same time. It's just one of those like, well, hurry up and wait, get that done. And then it's a hurry up and wait. That's when I feel like I'm at my most manic.
Ah.
Like I, in my mind, I just go nuts. Like when it's a hurry up and wait situation where it's like, all right, well, I got to do this at 2 PM. And then at 7 PM, I got to go do this. But there's a 2-hour gap. That 2-hour gap, I'm going insane. Just insane. Like, I have to find some way to keep myself preoccupied. Because if I'm not preoccupied, I just start thinking about the time. The time. Like, all right, now it's 45 minutes till I have to do this. Now it's 25 minutes. And, like, I just, it's the way I'm wired. I go nuts.
Do you get obsessive about any other things in areas similar to that?
Not really. I guess like if someone's running late and I didn't hear why they're running late, sometimes I'll obsess about it. I'll start to think of like all the bad things that could have happened to them, like car crash, sick kid. You know, why couldn't you tell me you were late? Why are you not answering a simple message? Because nobody picks up the phone when you call. We've learned this. It's
right.
You know, it's just how we're now conditioned. We're conditioned to read it first, process it, figure out what we're going to do. So people running late, and it's not me holding it against them. It's me like, why aren't you here? Why aren't you here? Why did I get here? Now, why am I here? Maybe if I came 15 minutes late, I wouldn't be feeling this way. So time is a weird thing for me.
There's a hang up involved in it somehow.
Yeah. I don't know where that ever came from or what scarred me in such a way where time is so, you know, meaningful to me. Because then you listen to like a Russell Brand when you say we're running out of time, he goes, "Well, time doesn't exist."
Yeah, it's an abstract concept that we constructed.
I'm like, I hate you so much for that, you jerk. How do you get wired not to care about time? But I'm sitting here freaking out over 15 minutes. Like,
yeah, I have that too. I don't know if you remember, but I used to live my entire life with a stopwatch.
You did.
That was a habit that I had to break.
Yeah.
And you've got a similar sort of wiring in that regard that I remember. It wasn't quite as obsessive as a stopwatch, but it was definitely something we had in common.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, like if the show is running late, if the band on stage before us was taking their sweet time tearing down.
Oh, man.
You and I would just be on fire. Like, why is the drummer going and getting a drink? You're supposed to be tearing down right now. You inconsiderate asshole.
to this day, I don't play nearly as much anymore. I play in what I affectionately call my old man band, because I'm 34 and everybody else is 47 plus.
Yeah.
So there's a big age gap, and it's so funny because, like, I'll be talking about, you know, whatever the new hip hop song is that I care about, and they're looking at me like I'm speaking a new language.
Yeah.
Like, I remember bringing up Lizzo way before she got big.
Well, and, she's always been big.
Well, she was big in Detroit for quite a few years before she went mainstream big.
Yeah, exactly. But now I guess that's a thing.
I'm going to say this, and ladies, I love you. I love you so much. You're awesome individuals, human beings. You're kicking men's ass in today's society. You white girls need to lay off Lizzo.
Yeah, no shit.
You need to bring it down several levels. Don't call her a spirit animal. It's great that you find her as a body positive thing, but also you stole the body positive thing. Because it started with black women, Latino women, like trying to say, like, hey, they're telling us we have to straighten our hair and lose weight. And then you white girls stole it a little bit. So just calm down. It's great. It's great that you're being the pariahs, but chill. Just chill just a little bit for me. Now you can call me an angry man and all the mean things on the Twitter that I don't have or really use. Have at it. But just chill a little bit. Stop stealing other people's cultural relevance. Please let them have it for a little bit. Then steal it.
Yeah, you know, once they're done with it, you can have it. That's how that works.
That's my big, like, current societal thing is like, you know, we have to pass laws in states so that, like, black women can have natural curly hair. But, like, all these other girls for years and years and years and years were able to dye their hair, like, five different colors and go to work with no issue.
Yeah.
So I'm like, let's not steal that from people. Let's let them have that. Let's step back, especially as a white society, like, let's step back a little bit. And this isn't, like, liberal, anti-white, reverse, whatever you want to call it. This is just me looking out at the landscape and saying, people need to chill for a minute. Just chill. Relax.
Yeah, and I think that that's, I think that that's a fair point. You know, especially right now, the thing that's really upset me in all of this for where we're at the moment is I've always been a fairly liberal dude politically, but I've never really considered myself to be, you know, a Republican, a Democrat, or anything. I mean, for me, it was always more or less policy issues. Like, how do we write policy that errs on the side of compassion for whoever? You know, like a blind system of justice where you don't know anything about the people these laws are being written about. How do you pass laws like that? And that's typically where I tend to land.
And it's hard to explain it because there's a stigma when you don't have titles now.
Yeah, people it's think easier. Like it's easier people when think you have titles.
Yeah, and they think that you're trying to wiggle out of something in case, like, you find yourself on the wrong side of their history. It's just at this point, man, we got to stop the whole, like, tribal everything, the label everything. I don't remember what comedian said it, like, a year ago in one of their specials, but the race to the woke Olympics needs to slow down.
Yeah.
You know, it's gotta slow down. And especially with young people who are just getting into the voting system and just getting into high school and trying to understand who it is that they are. I think, like, the one thing we always do is we always try and grow up too quick and be too smart too quick and know it all too quick. And now that I'm a little bit older, I don't like young me very much.
Yeah, no, completely. And you shouldn't.
I wasted a lot of development.
Well, no one should like young them. I mean, it's some of those things, too, the overconfidence in areas where you did not earn it was helpful in a lot of ways at the time.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing now, but it was definitely helpful to get you where you needed to be even if it was inarticulate and humbling in this moment. But how do you get from that guy to this guy? Like, what was, there anything in particular as far as picking yourself up and trying to make yourself a better human being that you got from somewhere other than just your own self?
Oh, that one's actually kind of easy. I really started to kind of have a shift in how I view things world-wise, even locally, when I started working in a town here in Michigan called Midland. Midland is the hometown to Dow Chemical. They're the ones that made Agent Orange, napalm. I mean, they build bad things. They build bad things. But because they build bad things, it's a very enriched area money-wise.
Yeah.
And because it's rich money-wise, it means it's predominantly white people. And I remember working this job, and I had made a comment towards someone being a bit snide and about, you know, the cultural relevance of the area, because I was like, well, this area is not very cultural to begin with. It's a bunch of German people and a bunch of Polish people that have Dow money, and then you bring in things for entertainment like the Irish dancers.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's not really that cultural. And they're like, oh, yes, it is. I'm like, really? Are you sure? He goes, well, I'll just say this. We just know how to let the right ones in.
Wow.
And I remember that hitting me in a way. I really do. I remember that hitting me in a way where I've never felt that mad by such a throw-off comment before. Like, because I'm 20. I think I was 28 at the time. So this is a little while ago. And I just remember being so enraged by it. And then I just started to notice, like, wow, this still really exists, and like in a very open form. And this was before the 2016 elections that created a fever pitch and all these other things politically that are starting to become a bigger narrative of our country.
Yeah.
And I just remember at that point, I'm like, okay, I'm seeing things a lot different. Maybe I was sheltered from it. Maybe my background didn't catch on right away, because I was always that weird kid that hung out with all the other weird kids. So I didn't see things that way. And
well, what did you pick up in that regard from your family life? Because usually you get things at least through context.
See, I was fortunate enough that they hated everyone. If you didn't live within the box that was our tiny little house, they wanted nothing to do with you. So no, there was no like people dropping the N-bomb or, you know, saying very disparaging racial things in the house. It really didn't exist. So in that respect, I'm fortunate, because they just literally were so, we don't want to deal with the outside world. We just want to exist. Like the upbringing was so weird, because when I try and explain it to people, they're like, how is that possible? How did they not want to like interact with people? I'm like, literally, they didn't want to interact with anyone.
Yeah, no, I get
zero.
It.
Zero.
That's an like, impulse that I fight within myself.
Yeah. So I unfortunately still have that in me. As I said, when you get invited to like a family's function and you're supposed to exist in it and, you know, be fun and energetic and like, this is great. All I want to do is eat my plate of, you know, bad left out sides and leave.
But like, there is a piece of you that wants some sort of connection in order to show up in the first place. It's just
doesn't
deliver on the promise of, you know, feeling that thing that you feel like you're owed for being a part of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm better now. I would say I'm far better now, and I'm more open to it because I made myself.
Yeah.
And I like it. I like that I've done it, and you know, I'm in a relationship now where the family is awesome and they're all really cool, creative people. So like, we can talk about those things. I can talk about music. I can, you know, bring up the stuff that I'm into, and there's going to be somebody there that's going to be like, yeah, I like that too. So like, that's really helped a lot. But on the other side of it, I have a family that's not ever going to show up to the 4th of July get together.
So you've seen a reflection of how you would like things to work and how you would like people to be in order to inform you of how you should be.
Yeah, I got to learn through somebody else's paint by numbers. It was kind of nice.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, they drew it out for me and they showed how it works. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. I can handle that. That's fine. Yeah, I'm coming, you know.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't at least touch on the sliver of time that we spent together.
Volatile and great and awful and fun. Yeah, and
it's
silly.
It's definitely got its moments, and they've been defining in both good and bad ways.
Oh yeah, I mean, me and you were always really good at butting heads because we were the only two that would actually just do it in a very reasonable manner.
Yeah,
like you and Char butting heads way different than you and I butting heads.
Absolutely. Yeah, it felt like there could be blood in that.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas you and I would be like, well, there's going to be a couple bruises, but we'll walk away from this fine. I'll see you in a week.
But we both came from that weird family dynamic where you expect some bruises in your conversation.
Yeah. So we kind of knew how to really not break each other too bad. But
so take me back a little bit, because I mean, I know the story, but I find it sort of fascinating, this whole band dynamic that was a lot more like a dysfunctional family that loved each other than any other band I've ever been in. So how did you get involved?
The best way to describe us was a foster home.
Oh my God. Yes.
we all got placed in the foster home, but then nobody wanted to tell the other person that we actually wanted to get adopted. We found ways to make sure we weren't adopted, but we didn't tell anybody about it. Like, we were just like, yeah, we don't really want to hang out with a new family, and we don't want any other new kids, so.
That sounds hard.
what I was doing, I was going to Jamestown Hall. Jamestown Hall was this little kind of gem for its time. And I was going there for a long time, from when I was about 14 till they stopped running shows there about 8 years ago. And you guys, in some various form, had started playing again in 2003. Monty, the wrangler of everybody, started just going there on his own, just to do stuff. He wasn't, you know, he went to work and that was it. And so yeah. I started talking to him, and I had like my own little goofy acoustic thing where I pretended not to be from the state of Michigan and that I was Scottish.
Yeah.
And so I do this whole, and what's funny is like, it fooled some people, not a lot, but I do like a really bad brogue. Like, it wasn't meant to be like an actual fool people accent, but somehow people just thought it was really me. And Monty saw right through it. He liked it because you guys were thinking about the band being a Saturday morning cartoon. You're all characters. Everybody was a character of some form.
Yeah.
And so he was like, yeah, this guy's weird. He'll probably dig it. And you know, Jekyll didn't know if he really wanted anybody in the band. Matt was playing bass, but was kind of trying to figure out his own adult life. And so I came in and I played keyboard and acoustic on one show, and it pissed Jekyll off. And then kind of stole Matt's spot on bass, but he kind of was like, just let him play bass. He's got one.
Yeah. Well, and Matt also recognized that, you know, you were kind of a real musician, and Matt was just interested in, you know, playing with this silly experiment.
Yeah. For him, it was like a weird, it was like, you know, putting a hallucinogen in the municipal tap water and calling it a band.
Yes.
You know, this
that's
was
precisely
like,
it.
What was that? Project Paperclip, I think is what they called it. Is that
yeah,
what that was?
Yeah.
It's one of those things. Somebody's will know, but, it was like one of those, and we all drank the water and stuck around for way too long.
Way too long.
In a good way. I mean, like, the results were there at the end. It's just that we were too old to pull it off.
Yeah. And I think that there was, by that point, there was also, you know, maybe a level of toxicity still existing in the dynamic that wasn't honestly being addressed.
Yeah, I mean, that's always going to be there. I mean, in some form. I mean, there's lead in the water. There's always lead.
Yeah.
But it's the amount, I guess, and how much you can handle. And I just think that the moniker success we did had came too late in where we were at that point, age-wise.
Absolutely.
And where everybody was going. I think if it happened 5 years earlier, more would have came from it, but I don't think the maturity was going to be there 5 years previous to the maturity at the end. But at the same time, I think we were all just done.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it was. We were done. It was almost like a good meal. We were fat and happy, and we can look back on it and be like, that was a damn good meal.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell my kids about that time I had that damn good meal. Like,
now I got to get a job.
and I think it all kind of hit all of us. Monty was doing okay with where he was working because he had been there so long. I was always floating in between jobs. I've always, unfortunately, been that way. I'm a little bit of a floater. That's why I said I'm a ghost in the wind at the beginning. I'm kind of always landing somewhere.
But after all of that ended, I know that you had done a couple of solo things and kicked around and played music a little bit, but
yeah, I did some weird stuff. I did a gypsy jazz band, dude.
Yeah.
Like Django Reinhardt, gypsy jazz for 3 years. Man. And it was a great learning experience because the one thing I never got good at was sheet music and the ability to pick it up quick. I can read music. I'm fortunate enough that I taught myself how to read notation, but I wasn't great at it. And so I started playing with this guy, and every show is just the sheet music's in front of you with the chord tones and a chord chart. And he's like, you got to figure it out. And it was great until he started 1099-ing me at the end of the year. All the money he was paying me in cash, he was 1099-ing me. I'm like, no, 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 dude, if you're going to 1099 me, you can W-2 me. I'm part of your business.
Yeah, really?
I'm an employee at this point. I have to be there at a certain time. I have to dress a certain way. I have to show up with a particular set of tools. I'm like, that's a full-time employee. That's not a 1099. That's not a contractor. So we parted ways, and now I play with an old local legend, Mick Furlough, which is one of the coolest gigs.
Yeah,
I play with Mick Furlough. Like, that's really cool. And he's a statesman, man. That's the best way to describe him. This dude's a journeyman. He's lessons every time you hang out with him. He's 20 plus years sober. So, you know, all of us don't drink and play, and it's like really
great.
Yeah. Like, I still from time to time will have like a beer here and there, but not when we're playing, not when we're rehearsing, obviously never there.
Yeah.
And, but I'm at a point now where it's like, I don't even need one now and again. I think I'm good at this point.
Like, that's kind of a strange place to come to, like, naturally. It's weird to look back on it and go, yeah, what was I doing with all that time?
Yeah, so like now it's so funny because there's a handful of friends that still go to the bar a lot, and I wish I could hang out with them, but I'm like, I just don't want to hang out at the bar anymore.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm good for maybe one or two. But, I mean, that's something that I learned here in Denver, strangely, is that...
The altitude will mess you up at first.
Well, it will at first, but then you're training at the Olympic level, and, you know, you go anywhere at sea level, and you're a monster.
Yeah.
But the thing I learned was that relationship with alcohol of, you know, let's have one and then go home.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that when I was living in Saginaw. And I think it's mostly because there was sort of a cultural thing where it was not really even ever spoken, but kind of implied.
It's a depressing place. It's a depressing place for a lot of people. And the need to numb yourself or cope is at such a high. You know, it's not a great area to find work. It's not a very pleasing area to find the arts. It's rough. It's rough in the sense of, there's not a lot of outlet and opportunity, so people medicate.
Yeah, completely. But what about
you?
I mean, as far as where you are now, it sounds like you've stopped self-medicating and that you've actually found yourself in a relationship that's healthy, and you feel good about where you are. Is that more or less right?
Yeah. The only thing that is my biggest problem now is finding steady work. You know, I've been bouncing I joined a union to do carpentry, and I was working for the last year, but the last 2 months without a single call has been kind of, you know, worrying because the money I did save as a nest egg is now going into rent and bills and car repairs and all that good stuff. So like, that's been a little disheartening, but that's just indicative of the area being out of work.
Yeah.
You know, no one's hiring. You can't go to work. It's just how it works. So brother.
So what do you do with your time?
I've been networking. I started a little video dubbing business called My Dub or MI Dub. And it's more of like a hobby thing. It's helped get some cash flowing into, and it's just to help people that have old VHS, old cassettes, old vinyl, preserve it, you know, transfer it onto DVDs or CDs for them. And I'm doing it cheaper than a company that's in the area. And then it's not to undercut them, but there's a lot of people that live in my Tri-Cities that are low-income housing. They have all these old family videos, old cassettes of, you know, before their mother passed away, they had their mother record, you know, things for their future children or, you know, things like that. And I'm trying to work with people that don't have a lot of money so that they have an option.
Yeah.
So it's a little humanitarian in that sense, but it's also, I do need to put some money in my pocket too. So I work with people in their budgets, and some people I price a little higher and some people I price a little lower. And I think that's fair.
Yeah.
And it's not to price gouge anyone by any means, but it's to give them an option that's affordable. So I've been doing that. It'd be cooler if it took off a little more with the holidays, but this is such a stressful time. Whether or not you're a holiday person or anything, it's just hard getting into that winter season and all the things that come with it.
How do you keep your head straight when it comes to you know, this time of year? Because I know that the gray skies and things like that can really get to people.
Well, I don't have to worry about my family because they're not worried about it. I remember really fun, quick stories. I remember one year, couldn't have been older than 11 or 12. Couldn't have been. And my mom goes, what do you want to do this year? Do you want to do Christmas or not? She's like, do you want to do a tree? Do you want to put the stuff up, or do you just want to not worry about it? And I just remember being at that age being like, I didn't even know that was an option.
Yeah, I thought this was state mandated.
Yeah, because like you're getting it smacked in your face in school. And then it's like, you know, I was not the kid when they said, well, you know, you got to bring treats to school for all your other classmates. I was like, that ain't happening.
Yeah.
Or you have to go door to door and sell the candy bars. I'm like, you can't make me do that. Teachers hated me because I'd sit it out every year. Every year when they do those candy drives, I'm like, I'm not doing it. And they're like, well, we're going to speak to your parents. And I'd be like, that's a bad idea. Because you're going to get either my dad, who's probably had a few, or you're going to get my mom, who's not in the mood. I don't know who's going to give you a better reaction, but it ain't going to be pretty. And they hate me. All my teachers hated me because my parents would be like, he doesn't have to do this. Does it reflect on his grades? That's what they would always say. Like, if it doesn't reflect on his grades, we're not making him do it.
Yeah.
So, the holiday thing's always been hilarious because we never did holidays in my family. They like, my mom sometimes like to pretend that it was a big deal, but I'm like, Mom, I remember you flipping out about not wanting to have to like worry about a dinner. So we had like frozen pizza.
Yeah.
That was the big thing. That was the big thing. Like DiGiorno, like late 90s was going to be like a big deal moving into the future. So we got a DiGiorno like one year for a holiday, and it was like an actual Christmas meal almost.
Do you think that those tougher experiences that were helpful at thickening your skin?
Oh yeah. I mean, if you've ever had to,
but how do you start to sand away the edges at some of that? So you, because after a certain point you can realize that some of your self-preservation comes across like just being an asshole.
Oh, it definitely comes across being an asshole. But I think I've learned that it's now my cross to bear, and it's not for me to reflect or use upon other people.
That's a good thing to learn.
Yeah. And it took me a while because it was like when you do the whole family thing and you see like somebody's got the haves versus the have nots and you got a chip on your shoulder and you're like, man, look at you. It's so nice that your parents can give you a $500 plus 10 gifts and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you just start to learn over time that, you know, that was, if it's going to be your hill to die on, make sure it's your hill.
That's,
you know,
really crazy.
It's your hill. This isn't a hill by committee. Okay.
Well,
that's not how they work. If you're going to fall on a sword, it's going to be yours. And like, there's not going to be four more people falling on it behind you. Like, they're going to look at you like, you're crazy. Go away.
Well, it's really great to hear that you've got a handle on yourself and that you're happy and that you're doing all right.
Yeah. I'm getting by. I'm never going to be anything other than my weird hermit self. If I don't have to leave the house or do some type of engagement, I'm probably not. There's certain things, like I've been going to concerts a little more. That's been fun. I got to see the Internet. I don't know if it's a group you're aware of, but I got to see them in the midwinter, early spring, and they're a band I always wanted to see, and I was so glad I went. Like, and also they have like a whip of shit bass player, so I got to watch that dude just go nuts, which was great. But I'm picking little things to give myself to be like, hey, you know, you're doing okay right now. Splurge on this. And then when times are lean, it's like, well, I know how times are lean and how to trim a little fat. So you go into the squirrel bearing a nut season, and then you get yourself out. And it's a waxing and waning of adulthood.
Work in progress.
We're always. Anyone who's saying that they've got to the end of their own personal tunnel is lying, delusional, or really optimistic, I guess. But
well, isn't really optimistic delusional?
Depending on who you talk to, I don't know. I'm not here to atone for anyone else.
I hear that. Thanks for talking to me today.
Hey, I appreciate you reaching out at the last minute. You must really had to scratch the bottom of the barrel to call me.
No, I love you, brother.
I love you too, brother. You're gonna be saying it all the time now. I just know it.
Everybody can look out for that.
Yeah, brother.
And there you have it. Brother, sister, pal, friend, whatever you are, whoever you are, wherever you are. I want to thank you for listening to this show, and if you stick around for just a few more seconds, you're going to get to hear a musical performance by Sean Drysdale. And if you want some more Sean Drysdale in your life, and I know you do, you can find him on Facebook as Sean Drysdale Bass. There's a link in the feed below. And as always, you can check him out in the band I was in with him for the 10 years called The Banana Convention. There's CDs and stuff on iTunes, Spotify, everywhere that you can find music, just like this podcast. But you know what? I'm going to stop talking, and you're going to hear his voice. But until next year, don't kill yourselves out there.
Let's see if we can do this one. Ain't no rivers in our anymore. mama said, be a good boy, be true to all of them. But I don't know what makes me a boy, makes them men. But if I'm sure, I might just learn some time. My baby's sure missing. Baby, she sure missin'.